I'm Jim Browdy. She is Emily Rooney. Marjorie Egan is back tomorrow, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio. You know, Emily, yesterday you and I disagreed on some public health thing. We even disagreed today on whether spring has come.
Yeah,
look outside.
Not.
Sun's happening.
No, yeah, horrible.
It is not horrible. Sun is the critical ingredient of spring. 7:02 this morning. It's going to what?
Snow.
No, it is not. In any case, the gun control battle took a major turn in the U.S. Senate yesterday. On the line from D.C. to discuss what happened and what it means is Todd Zwillick. He's the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Thanks for calling in, Todd.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
So fine, thanks. Good to join you.
Yeah. So, Todd, yesterday you spoke to the chief Senate sponsor of this, Dianne Feinstein, who's so frustrated by this. And she was talking to people about how she was the one who found San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk 35 years ago when he was gunned down by that Twinkie defense nut. And, you know, she had to touch his body and she found bullet holes in him. She's been so profoundly affected by that. She was pushing through this assault weapons ban. And here's what she told you what happened yesterday.
And that's the problem with this place, that, you know, the gun lobby is inordinately powerful. And, you know, as I've said, if this got 10% in every poll or 20% or 40%, I'd understand it. But it's gotten the majority support in virtually every single poll that's been done. And my God, the NRA says there are already 2 to 3 million of these. Isn't that enough in America? I mean, how many assault weapons do you need circulating?
So, Todd, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid told Dianne Feinstein that he would vote for the ban, and then he reversed himself. Why?
Well, it's actually two different things. He told Senator Feinstein that he would vote for the ban, and he still might, because Senator Feinstein will still get a vote on her amendment. Here's the difference. Senator Feinstein's assault weapons ban, which would essentially renew the 1994 ban, which expired in 2004 under President Bush, will not be in the bill, the gun control bill, that reaches the Senate floor, presumably after the Easter Passover recess in April. Now, what does that mean? If it's not going to be in the bill that reaches the floor, as everybody knows, the Senate votes on amendments all the time. That means that Dianne Feinstein can still introduce an assault weapons ban as an amendment.
Yeah.
But it also means she's going to need 60 votes to get it in there. There are not 60 votes to get it in there. If it had been in the base bill, it would have been safely ensconced, and an enemy of the assault weapons ban would have needed 60 votes to get it out. So that's the difference. She just doesn't have the votes to do it. Harry Reid told reporters yesterday that he didn't think the assault weapons ban even had 40, which would be the number of votes needed to keep it in the bill, that an enemy of the assault weapons ban would have been able to strip it out anyway. Also, Harry Reid is thinking forward to what can pass the House. Let's always remember here, the House Republican Conference is a conservative place. It's more conservative than it was even 10 years ago, and it's more conservative than the Senate. John Boehner, to an extent, and Eric Cantor rule the House with majority rule. What Democrats want doesn't really matter all that much. And an assault weapons ban would never pass the House. And if it didn't, Barack Obama would have nothing to show for his desire for some form of gun control in the wake of Newtown and other shootings that we've seen.
Todd Zwillick, I understand the assault weapons ban thing was pulled out. How about the high-capacity magazine provision? Is that in the bill that Reid is going to allow to go to the floor, or is that stripped as well?
It's a great question, Jim. It is not in the bill, but apparently Dianne Feinstein gets two votes if she wants them. She gets the assault weapons vote, which I'm sure she'll want to have. It'll fail. Then a separate vote on high-capacity clips, which some Republicans have shown a willingness to support. Now, will they support it? They always look at the broader context of the bill, where they think the bill is going. A bill that's going to die is a different vote than a bill that's going to succeed. A bill that's going to become law is a different vote than a bill that's just a show vote. But it looks like Feinstein's also going to get a vote on her ban on high-capacity clips. Other senators like Lautenberg of Virginia, of New Jersey, have supported this for a long time. So it's not in the bill, but they're going to try to get it in after Easter.
That soundbite that we played a minute ago when you were speaking to Dianne Feinstein yesterday, Senator Feinstein, yesterday, she talked about the power of the NRA. It seems to me that Harry Reid could take that personally.
Yeah.
Could he not? Basically, she's saying not only does the NRA own a huge number of moderate Democrats and Republicans, they also own the president of the Senate, who could decide to put this whole thing on the floor, no?
Yeah, majority leader of the
Senate. Majority leader, my apologies.
Well, it's okay. Sure. He could take it personally, I suppose. They tend not to in this game. Look, Harry Reid's position on an assault weapons ban has never been a secret. He voted against it in 1994. He voted against the renewal of it in 2004. He did tell Senator Feinstein he would vote for it this time, but looks like it's not going to matter either way. Now, Harry Reid is not alone on this, but he is emblematic of an important dynamic here in the Senate. He is a Democratic senator from a fairly conservative state, Nevada. They carry guns out there. They like their guns, and they don't like gun laws. Let me list a couple of other Democrats for you. And you alluded to this, Jim. Mark Begich of Alaska. Mark Pryor of Arkansas. Mark Udall of Colorado. We're going down the list of Democrats who are up for re-election in 2014 in red states. They don't want to vote for an assault weapons ban.
But don't
they
you
don't
appreciate-
want to vote for...
Todd, look, don't you appreciate the irony? You just listed the Colorado senator. This falling apart, at least the broader gun control measure, comes on the same day that Colorado, which is not exactly a radical anti-NRA state, decides to pass and have signed into law pretty far-reaching gun control on the state level.
Yeah. And that makes you wonder exactly what is going to get through the Senate. And part of the legislative logic, if you will, of what Harry Reid is thinking of by not including the assault weapons ban is getting other things passed. There are other aspects of the gun control package that probably will pass out of the Senate. Remains to be seen whether it will pass out of the whole Congress. Nothing close to what President Obama said he wanted after Newtown. So you're talking about some gun trafficking crackdowns on straw purchases, which means you're not allowed to buy a gun legally because maybe you have a felony background. I'll go and buy it for you and you give me the money. Hard to track, technically illegal, but in some places even not illegal technically. They want to crack down on that and make that illegal. What will they get on high capacity clips? There is also the issue of background checks. There have been bipartisan discussions going on for about 6 weeks on universal background checks. They've all but fallen apart, guys, on a bipartisan basis. Chuck Schumer does have a bill. He does not have the support of Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, who he was negotiating with. Will universal background checks be included in the Senate bill? It's looking like that one is on the cusp of failing as well to get in that bill. You need 60 votes to get it in, and then that's a heavy lift. So you're looking at gun legislation that will probably pass in some form, but it's probably going to be really, really thin compared to what people said in the polls and what the president said he wanted in the wake of Newtown and Aurora and the shooting of Gabby Giffords in Tucson, Arizona. Go down the list.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, Todd, honestly, who is this going to satisfy? Not a single person. Certainly nobody from the Newtown, Connecticut,
Wayne
LaPierre, or anybody
will be satisfied.
Aurora, California. Yeah, but why bother with the legislation? This is all common sense anyway. It's like when we're talking about this, what's the point of this? This is not really going to satisfy anybody.
And look, this is the very frustrating nature often of legislation. People who traffic in cliches run around here all the time and say that legislating is the art of the possible. I'll bookend that with saying it's a cliche. But that's what they'll tell you if you express that frustration around here. Congress does not always respond to the very clear message in the polls. You read national polls, 70-80% of people say they favor a renewal of the assault weapons ban. But to the congressman from a district in rural Missouri or the senator running for re-election in Alaska, that is irrelevant. They only care what their internal polls in their internal states and their internal districts say to them, regardless of what the national poll says. They're willing to face the frustration and opprobrium of people on the national stage, even the president himself. If you're running for re-election in Alaska and you're a Democrat, maybe it benefits you to show your voters back home that there's plenty of daylight between you and the Democratic president, who they don't necessarily like. It actually isn't just avoiding damage by voting for the assault weapons ban. You might actually be doing yourself a favor.
You know, your job, I know, is to report what is rather than talk about what the future holds. But it seems to me, and I think it's a pretty obvious point, that if Newtown could not cause far-reaching gun control legislation to make it through Congress, then nothing ever is going to do it. Maybe they'll come out with a limited universal background check, if that's not an oxymoron. But that is the sense of the Feinsteins of the world in Washington. If we can't do this after Newtown, then we can never do anything. Isn't that a fair statement?
Well, it sure seems that way. Again, you know, like you stipulated there, who knows what will happen in the future? One certainly hopes that it's not a question of more and more tragedies that build up to test the theory. of course. But one thing that's important to remember also when it comes to gun control legislation, the assault weapons ban has been in place before. It expired, as we said. It's one of the most emotional and salient parts of this. It is unclear what effect the previous assault weapons ban had on morbidity and mortality when it comes to guns, and certainly on mass shootings. Mass shootings are huge in the media. They're tragic, but they remain rare. The vast majority of the 30 to 35,000 gun deaths in this country every year, of course, come from handguns, and we all know that handguns aren't going anywhere.
But obviously Aurora and Newtown were exceptions to that notion. Now, let's talk about the president for a second. We're talking to Todd Zwillick, who is the Washington correspondent for the takeaway. We're talking about what happened in the Senate yesterday on the Dianne Feinstein's gun control legislation. We all know that in his first term, the only thing the president did on gun control was actually do something that would make the NRA happy. I remember one of the things was allowing weapons to be carried in parks, and I can't remember what the other thing was. Is the president, other than the speechifying, is he doing anything? Is he exerting any pressure on moderate Democrats, including Harry Reid, to do the right thing here?
The White House chief of staff was on the Sunday shows just this weekend, Jim, saying that they would continue to exert pressure, that they do want to see a significant universal background check bill, saying we will round up the votes for it. So maybe the answer to that remains to be seen. The White House, you know, if you watch them closely, when the president sort of moved quickly and had Joe Biden, you know, remember, head the commission on suggested gun control legislation after Newtown, they were pretty careful not to place the assault weapons ban at the very center of their proposal, not to make it appear like this was all about controlling assault weapons. The president had all of the appropriate caveats when he appeared in the briefing room to talk to reporters about what he wanted, you know, constructively to come out of these tragedies. And they did that for a reason. It's not really a surprise to anyone around here that the assault weapons ban is dead. It's counterintuitive because it's so popular, because people want it, because they see the types of weapons that are used in these high-profile mass shootings. But the legislative reality, which the White House full well knows, and those of us who hang around here enough know, it was a really long shot to begin with. So is the president exerting real pressure? Let's wait and see what they get on universal background checks. You will know the answer to that if a universal background check bill, which looks like it's circling the drain a bit right now, if they manage to pull that back and get it through the Senate, you'll know that the White House had a heavy hand in doing it.
But the likelihood of them getting it through the House of Representatives or the Republican majority, I assume, is modest at best. Is that so?
It is a lot less likely than getting it through the Senate. The difference in the dynamic there, though, is that once it passes out of the Senate, and if it passes with decent numbers, that can put additional pressure on the House to pass something. There's a difference between going first and saying, well, this is our bill. Here it is on the table. Take it or leave it. And having a bill that passed the Senate, maybe with a number of Republicans, has the support of the president, has public pressure, then the narrative becomes, hey, House Republicans, are you going to be the only thing standing between the status quo and at least some form of gun control legislation after these tragedies? Are you going to be the only ones? Their answer might be yes, but then they'll have to defend that in the court of public opinion. They'll have to defend that back home. Part of the question then you ask is, are there many or any Republicans who back home would have trouble with that vote, or would it actually benefit them? Do their constituents in their specially drawn districts, which protect incumbency, want them to vote for any gun control legislation, or will they say, good job in voting against it, even if we're not going to do anything?
So it sounds like, Todd, that the best scenario for the gun lobby would be to leave this up for the states, because then it wouldn't make any difference.
Well, the best scenario for the gun lobby is always no gun control legislation. I mean, their record here on the Hill is to basically fight every single shred of gun control regulation that comes through. Incidentally, if you roll the clock back 10 years, you do have tape of Wayne LaPierre telling hearings here on the Capitol Hill that the NRA does support universal background checks. Their position has changed since that testimony 10 years ago, when people were wondering, now that the assault weapons ban is expiring, what are we going to do in its place that has a semblance of gun control? Around that time, the NRA was all for background checks. They're not anymore. So yes, you then go to the states and they fight state by state, just as they do here on Capitol Hill. Wayne LaPierre and the NRA can't be happy about the legislation that Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado signed just yesterday, which you guys mentioned.
Hey, Todd, before you go away, talking to Todd Zwillick from Washington correspondent for The Takeaway, what did cause the turnaround for LaPierre from a decade ago in universal background checks to where he is now? What's his answer when asked?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know that I have a factual answer for you. It is certainly well known, and you can read up. There's some interesting books on this of sort of the hardening of the NRA position. Back in the Clinton years, you know, remember trigger locks and the assault weapons mm-hmm. bans that originally passed? There were divisions in the gun manufacturing community about gun control even back then. Voluntary trigger locks, I remember the gun manufacturer Glock was for it, while the rest of the gun lobby was against it. And there were some divisions there. Since then, the NRA and other gun lobby organizations have really moved their public positioning, their rhetoric, even further to the right, where there really doesn't seem to be any reasonable gun control legislation in their view. They have the benefit of the Heller decision, the Supreme Court decision, which affirmed an individual right to bear arms. And since then, I don't think that they really feel any need constitutionally or politically to compromise.
On that optimistic note, Todd, thank you so much for joining us. Todd Zwillick, the Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. We appreciate your time, Todd.
Pleasure, guys. Anytime.
You know, Jim, another issue that's contentious on the Hill these days is the Keystone Pipeline. We're going to be talking to one man who's leading the charge against this huge underground undertaking. He's the acclaimed journalist and environmentalist, Bill McKibben. He joins us next on Boston Public Radio.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Emily Rooney. Yesterday, the Boston Phoenix published an online piece by journalist Bill McKibben entitled "The Good Fight: Why the Massachusetts Democratic Primary is Unexpectedly One of the Hottest Fronts in the Planet's Biggest Battles." That battle, of course, being the Keystone Pipeline. Time magazine called this guy the world's best green journalist. He led the formation of 350.org. Bill McKibben now joins us from Vermont. Bill, thanks so much for your time.
Hey, good to be with you as always.
Hey, Bill. Good to have you. So, here we've got this pipeline that goes, you know, all through the Midwest and some northern Alberta, Canada. It's nowhere near Massachusetts. And you're telling us it's one of the biggest issues in the Massachusetts Democratic primary. Why is that?
Well, can I just say one thing first, which was that it was a very, very bittersweet honor to have, I think, what really is the last piece of the Boston Phoenix. It won't even make the print edition.
Yeah. I know. We've talked a lot about that.
Yeah, online.
The last online edition is this Friday. So
that's the back to, you know, my boyhood in Boston. I mean, the Phoenix has been a kind of constant, and what a shame to see it go. Look, the reason that this is a big deal is, A, it's become the most important climate fight that there ever has been in this country, the biggest single battle. I mean, we had 50,000 people in D.C., 3 weeks ago for a huge climate rally in the bitter cold. 1,253 Americans have gone to jail, the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years. And when you get to this Democratic primary, Stephen Lynch and Ed Markey have lined up on the absolute opposite sides. Lynch, a few weeks after Jim Hansen at NASA, our greatest climatologist, said, "Burn the tar sands on top of everything else we're burning, and it's game over for the climate," he voted in favor of this pipeline. That was strike one. Strike two was after everybody had gone to jail, after it had become this huge political issue, and after President Obama had said, "We need to take a year to study this further," Representative Lynch voted with a handful of other very conservative Democrats and virtually all the Republicans to say, "No, we want to take this away from the president and immediately approve this pipeline." He's been on the absolute wrong side of an absolutely crucial issue. And so we're going to do our best, especially on college campuses in Massachusetts, because all the polling data shows, as you might expect, that young people care about climate change and about Keystone most of all. If you've got 60 or 70 years left on this planet, then those graphs of rising temperature and rising sea level are even more sobering than they are for the rest of us. Those are going to define our lives.
All right, but as you know, Stephen Lynch's position on this is really about having America be less dependent on foreign oil. He's done a lot of traveling to the Middle East. He says it's a big jobs creator, and that like nuclear power plants, you know, there's going to be a, you know, everything's going to be done just, so carefully. There will be no leaks and spills. He's confident.
This is wrong on the just, but it just turns out to be wrong. So basically wrong on the facts that it's almost. It's almost sad. I mean, it's not, doesn't do anything for the national security of the United States, the energy security, as the Wall Street Journal pointed out last week. The whole thing's an export pipeline. It goes to refineries on the Gulf Coast of Mexico, and then it goes straight overseas. It doesn't even come here. And as for the jobs, the company itself admitted 2 weeks ago that there would be a grand total of 35 permanent jobs associated with this pipeline. Yes, for a year or two, there'll be some good jobs digging the thing. That's it. The jobs come when we make, and this is a place where Representative Markey, I think, has really been smart over the years. The jobs come when we make the transition away from fossil fuel, which is capital-intensive, not labor-intensive, and toward renewable energy. It takes a lot of people to put up those solar panels and to insulate homes, and they have to be Americans. No one's going to put their house in a boat and send it to China to get it insulated.
We're talking to Bill McKibben. If you want to talk to him about the Keystone XL pipeline, give him a buzz, 877-301-8970. So you and your colleagues are still waiting for the president to weigh in. I'm assuming that when the State Department issued that report a couple of weeks ago on the environmental impacts, which it seems to me as a non-expert in the area was wishy-washy at best, that was not a particularly good omen about where Obama ends up. Was it, Bill McKibben?
You know, I don't know. I guess I've sort of given up thinking about omens at this point. When we started this work 18 months ago, nobody thought we had a chance. The National Journal, the kind of Washington insider magazine, polled its energy insiders, and 97% of them said that TransCanada would have their permit for the Keystone Pipeline by the end of 2011. So we've held them up for going on a year and a half, and we're going to keep fighting. And the good news is that the movement to do something about it has grown really large. If you could have seen that scene in Washington 3 weeks ago with a lot of Bay Staters, among others, down there demonstrating their resolve on, you know, nobody was there by accident. It was 15 degrees and the wind was blowing across the mall.
And that's the hardest part, to put your body where your head is. But every poll I've seen, Bill, starting as recently as, you know, as long ago as a year ago to as recently as a few weeks ago, 2-3-1. The American people support this construction. So even if you're right...
New poll out this morning, in fact, you
can
read it in Politico.
Saying what?
It says that it's almost evenly split, 50-42 in favor, but all the people who are in favor are Republicans. Among President Obama's base, there's big opposition. Among young voters, there's almost overwhelming opposition. Now, you would not be surprised that we're behind in this fight, because the fossil fuel industry has spent literally hundreds of millions of dollars. It's been hard to turn on a TV without seeing an ad, you know, over and over and over again for this thing. And to counter that, we've had the currencies of movement, you know, passion and spirit and creativity, and sometimes we've spent our bodies. You know, Jim Antall, the chief minister for the United Church of Christ in Massachusetts, was three cells down from me for 3 days in central cell block in D.C. That was, you know, part of what helped get people going. In the end, however, the poll that matters, I guess, in a sense, is a poll of one. President Obama will decide, without Congress hopefully in the way, what happens. Although the Senate is going to take a vote this week on it. I mean, these are the kind of votes that we need reliable environmentalists there for, people like, I think, Ed Markey.
But as Jim pointed out, the State Department has to give permission for this thing first, because it
crosses. State Department has to give a recommendation to the president.
They have to give a permit.
Yeah, and so we're waiting to see what John Kerry.
If they nix it, then it's dead, right?
So, yes, if they I mean, truthfully, nothing ever quite dies in process, as far as I can tell. But yes, it would complicate matters for the Koch brothers and the other pipeline builders.
Bill McKibben, let's go back to the beginning of this conversation. For those actually who are not as familiar with this whole issue as they probably should be, give us the Cliff Notes version of why this is, as James Hansen said, game over for climate change. Why is this the most dramatic test for you guys?
Well, because it runs from the second biggest pool of carbon on Earth, which are these tar sands in Canada. If you burned all the recoverable oil up there, it would amount to more oil than I think we've burned so far in human history. It's a huge quantity of oil. And so far...
You said number two. Number one, I assume, is Saudi Arabia.
Okay, go ahead. And burning Saudi Arabia, you know, is more than anything else what's raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree already. It's why the Arctic is melted. It's why the Atlantic Ocean is 30% more acidic than it used to be. It's, you know, why everybody's having to hunker down along the coast to figure out how to deal with storm surge and keep their house from washing away. So we don't want to go further down this and opening up a huge new thing guarantee. I mean, this pipeline's supposed to last 40 years. It guarantees another 40 years of doing what we're doing now. A really good environmentalist on the West Coast, a guy named Casey Golden, wrote a little essay called The Keystone Principle, and he said, we have to stop locking in future climate change. It's hard enough just sort of getting off the infrastructure we've already built, you know, rehabbing houses and buildings and so on and so forth, but we can't keep locking new stuff in. Another way to say this, less articulate, would be to say, when you're in a hole, the first rule is stop digging. In this case, literally, stop digging.
And if it's so obvious, Bill McKibben, to people who spend their lives working on such things, the Hansons, the Hughes, the other people, why has Barack Obama been so hesitant to just end this thing? I mean, one would expect...
Because the fossil fuel industry is the richest and most powerful industry in history. I mean, no hyperbole. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. They have huge leases in the tar sands. The Koch brothers spend more money on American politics than any other individuals. They have huge holdings in the tar sands. You know, when Steve Lynch helps the tar sands people, he's handing a big gift to Charles and David Koch.
Couldn't you make the case that Barack Obama is helping them too? If they are the richest and biggest donors, they're still going to be the richest and biggest donors in 6 months or a year, right? So he's part of the problem too.
I think there's no question. The fossil fuel industry has bought one party and scared the other. And that's a huge problem. And people have to start standing up to it. And we need some politicians who are willing to stand up to it. And, you know, for once, Massachusetts has a chance to kind of, there's actually a sort of big compelling difference there. It's not just the 350.org action fund that's noticed either. You know, young people all over the state, people sent a powerful letter to Stephen Lynch yesterday asking him to, by Friday, change his position, or they were going all in. It's important, this.
I'm curious to know, by the way, to our listeners, if that will make a difference, Jim. They should give us a call, 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. Would you vote for or against Ed Markey or Stephen Lynch on this issue of the Keystone Pipeline? Are people really worked up about it here?
I mean, isn't that beyond the polling numbers? I think Emily asked a great question. Is even if the polling numbers are closer than I was describing, Bill McKibben, the reality is it doesn't seem to be a front burner issue. You stop people. The budget is, gun control is. I'm talking about real people for the moment. Maybe immigration is, but you don't hear climate change issues in the subset.
Climate change on any given day. Climate change is almost never the most important thing that's going on in the world. There's always something more dramatic and immediate. On every given day, climate change is the most important thing going on in the world, just in the background, inexorably, powerfully, and, you know. And when it shows up, then it shows up with a vengeance in the form of Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Irene or the drought across the Midwest or the wildfires across the far west or all the other things all over the world. And it shows up more and more and more all the time. You know, when I wrote the first book about this a quarter century ago, I didn't have any doubt it was going to happen, but we didn't know how quickly and on what scale. And the truth is, what's surprised everybody in that quarter century who pays attention is how fast it's come and how much damage we've seen. No one would have thought 25 years ago that we would have melted the Arctic by this point.
A bunch of people want to talk to you, Bill McKibben. Let's take some. Tracy on the Mass Pike, you're on with Bill McKibben on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Tracy.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I applaud the efforts of the environmentalists that are speaking truth to power or truth to corporate money. I'm glad and proud that this president postponed this pipeline getting red-lighted with nothing, or green-lighted, with nothing more than an industry report from the industry. Billions of dollars in businesses are supported by the aquifers and natural resources that this pipeline would negatively affect. And I just want to point out, there's nothing conservative about ignoring global warming, believing the Earth isn't warming at 5,000 years old, and I wish more voters would recognize that. And
so I'm will you vote against Stephen Lynch?
Absolutely. And his vote against women and choice. But absolutely, and I will volunteer to get the word out on this really dangerous and short-sighted vote.
Tracy, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Fran, you're in Acton. You're on with Bill McKibben at 877-301-8970. Hello, Fran.
Hi. Nice to be able to talk to you guys. I'm a huge fan of Bill McKibben's.
Yep.
We even do, like, church groups reading his book, $100 Holiday. But I have a question in the latest issue of Time. Fareed Zakaria says, who cares whether this goes through? We're still going to be in rampant demand for oil. So...
Yep.
It's either from Alberta or it's from Saudi Arabia.
Yep. So, I mean, look, no one should confuse what I'm saying with with something else, which would be to say, if you stopped the Keystone Pipeline, you'd have dealt with climate change. You won't. It's one thing that we can do to keep it from getting beyond our capacity to deal with. But we have to do an amazing number of other things, too. And cutting demand is high on the list. In fact, I mean, you know, if you had a working democratic process in this country on these issues, it would be the highest thing on the list to be getting a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere, so on and so forth. For 25 years, we've had a terrific effort in Washington to accomplish nothing, and it's been entirely successful. And it's why we have to play defense against these horrible projects. And it's why we have to play offense, too. One of the things that's really exciting that's going on across the Commonwealth and across the country is this rapid, rapid rise in the fossil fuel divestment movement on college campuses and now spreading to local governments and things. 256 mm-hmm. college campuses are having a huge battle about this now. It's by far the biggest thing of its kind since the fights against apartheid in the 1980s on college campuses. And, of course, Massachusetts being cradle of campuses, it's more intense there than just about any place else. So that plays into this, too. And it's young people that are driving this fight so spectacularly.
Fran, thank you for the call. I'm sorry, Fran.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, I have a question. But, I mean, my husband and I are like, oh, if only we could get an electric car, you know. If there were just plenty of electric car dealerships, people would buy them.
No, they wouldn't. They don't go fast
the good
enough.
News. Around the edges, you can at least start. I had to get a new car this year. My old Honda Civic Hybrid, after 12 years, had worn out. So I got the first of these, first generation of Ford. It's called the C-Max Hybrid Electric. And I plug it into the wall, and I get about 25 miles on the electric before the efficient gas motor kicks in. Only 4,000 miles on it, but so far, so good.
Bill McKibben, you plug it into the wall? You don't need one of those special things we see throughout the state? You plug it into a regular outlet?
You plug it into a regular outlet. Yeah.
Love that. Fran, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Since I've got solar panels on my roof, in essence, I get to plug it into the sun. So that feels good.
Boy, I'll tell you, Chip,
yeah,
you're in a car. You're on with Bill McKibben on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Chip.
Hi, how you doing, Bill?
Yeah, hello
Bill,
there.
I was thinking, well, why, you know, there's if you want to create jobs, why don't we build a refinery, which we need in this country really desperately, in the Chicago-Detroit location where people need jobs and they need energy, and it would be less transport. Why don't we go ahead and switch over to alternative fuels?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's lots of things that we could and should be doing. And the trouble with doing things like Keystone is that it delays making the transition to more sensible things, slows it down. Here's an example. We look at the one big country on Earth that's taken this stuff seriously, the one non-Scandinavian country, and that's Germany. There were days this summer when the Germans generated more than half the energy they used from solar panels within their borders. This is Germany. Munich is north of Montreal. It's not Arizona or Texas or California or Nevada, New Mexico. What it demonstrates is that what we lack to make the transition is less technology than political will. And the longer we just keep married to the old system, the longer that'll continue. And the longer that the trouble is, at this point, the window that physics is giving us to deal with climate change is really, really short. That's what a melting Arctic means. So I think your point's very well taken.
Hey, Chip, thanks for the call. Bill McKibben, though, when you see, you've cited Massachusetts many times, used to live here, when you see that the Cape Wind has been in the works for virtually forever, I think is the appropriate amount of time. And I actually did a forum with you once where you said you were sitting on a mountaintop or somewhere where all of a sudden you said no matter where they have to build windmills, they should do it regardless of what it does to the landscape. Is that
no,
fair?
I didn't say that. I said we need to build them. The sort of benefit of the doubt should go to building such things. We don't want to put them everywhere. We need to be careful about siting them. But Cape Wind is a perfect example of a very well-cited project. And, of course, one of the great ironies of it is that some of the money, a not inconsiderate part of the money that's gone into opposing it, has come from yet another of the Koch brothers.
I've been misquoting you, by the way, for 5 years, so let me apologize right here. So the reality, but taking that as a case study, if Cape Wind off the coast of the most liberal state or one of the most liberal states in America – with the governor, by the way, who stood up to Ted Kennedy on this issue, which was not easy for him. Deval Patrick is having so much trouble, I was going to say breaking ground, breaking water, whatever you do there. Isn't that a horrible sign for the future?
Breaking wind, I think you would say.
Well, whatever, wind, beautifully put. But isn't that a really bad omen for the future?
Hey, look, if you were a betting person, you'd bet we're going to lose this big overall fight. I mean, the name of the book I wrote about this 25 years ago was The End of Nature, so I'm no Pollyanna. But the good news is that there's a real movement arising, and it's that movement that it's going to take to break these sort of political stalemates and break the political power of this industry. And that's why we need champions of that movement in places like Congress, not opponents of it. It's the only real hope that we've got. And it is, you know, the progress is beginning to appear. It just has to go faster, faster. We have to have Cape Wind, and then there have to be Cape Winds. You know, all the other ones on the drawing boards up and down the Atlantic coast have to be there. And soon, the University of Delaware did a study in January that was really hopeful. It looked at, I think it did 28 billion computer simulations of weather conditions over the last however many years, and it said by 2030, if we were serious about putting in the wind turbines and the solar panels, the U.S. could be affordably and reliably generating its power from renewables 99.9% of the time. That's, you know, that's pretty good.
Hey, we're going to take one more call for you, but before we do, Bill McKibben, I think in fairness to Stephen Lynch, while you characterize his votes accurately, I saw him last night on television, and he did not say that he ultimately would not come around to a position that you would find more favorable. He was resenting the deadline that had been given him, saying that he'd either do it by Friday at noon or whatever the deadline was, or else. So for those who are in Massachusetts who are concerned about this, Lynch at least says that he has not completely made up his mind. Let's go to Acton, where Deborah is on with Bill McKibben on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, thanks so much. I just want to chime in. I am one of those 50,000 people that was on the mall back in February, and there were, in fact, about a dozen of us from Acton, so I was very proud of my community. And I wanted to respond to Emily's question about whether this would affect my, you know, my voting in the primary, and the answer is absolutely I will. I mean, I feel like, honestly, I've been forced to become a one-issue person because I will never again cast a vote for anyone who will deny climate change, who will not, you know, really pledge him or herself to work actively on serious, you know, at-scale resolutions to this issue. And I'm sorry to say that I've you know, have to become that, but I have had to. Hi, Bill. I have been involved with 350 for years at this point, and, you know, we do what we do personally. I have the solar panels. I drive a hybrid. I, you know, blah, blah, blah. But honestly, I think the divestment initiative, which is fabulous, and I'm so thrilled to see more and more schools getting on board with that. And I think getting the clout out of the fossil fuel industry, and whether that's through an amendment to the Constitution or whatever we need to need to do is really where it's at. If we don't get a price on carbon, we're cooked, and I mean it obviously on every level.
Deborah, thank you. We really appreciate your call.
All right, Deborah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if this is resonating statewide, Jim. I mean, Bill McKibben's efforts notwithstanding, I'm not sure this is going to be the issue.
Bless that, you, Bill McKibben.
That Massachusetts voters determine the Senate race over. Do you think so?
Well, I would have said no a couple of days ago, but actually the deadline that I was just reacting to
April 30th.
Steve Lynch did cause the Steve Lynch deadline that was good. Actually caused news reporters last night to do some stories on this.
Is it the deadline the same day as the race?
Is that my understanding is the deadline, Bill McKibben, that's been given to Lynch to turn around, for lack of a better expression, is this Friday. Am I right about that?
That's from another group of people.
Okay.
There's a bunch of young people and Tom Steyer, the huge big Democratic Party donor and things, who have been making that request. Our work's going to be, and here's the reason I think it may actually have an effect. You know, these special elections are often low turnout affairs, and we're going to be on college campuses all over the Bay State. That's where 350.org Action Fund is going to do most of its work, because we know that college kids are desperate for a way to make clear their, I mean, it's by this point more than a hope. It's a demand that the rest of this society take seriously the fact that their lives are going to be degraded and really damaged by this stuff. And it's up to the rest of us to start paying a little attention to them and taking it halfway seriously.
Bill McKibben, 350.org. Thanks so much for your time, Bill.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon. Bill McKibben of 350.org and the End of Nature, which probably started the whole environmental movement, did it not, a quarter of a century ago?
Probably did. Well, as you know, Jim, one way to help the environment is to get around on foot. You know, I do a lot of that because I don't take the T.
I was told that you don't take the T.
It's also the focus of an inventive, albeit ridiculous, public health campaign coming out of New York. So could Boston learn something about weight loss from the Big Apple? We're going to be talking about that next on Boston Public Radio.
PRI Selected Shorts is coming to the Huntington Theater Company with Selected Shorts on Tour, tales of springtime, sex, and baseball. And if you like any of those things, you're guaranteed to have a good time. Support Boston Public Radio with a gift of $100 right now, and we'll say thanks with a pair of tickets to either the 4 p.m. or 8 p.m. show on June 8th, starring actors Dennis O'Hare, Amy Ryan, and Kate Burton. Call 888-897-9424 and thanks.
Funding for our programs comes from you. And Orchard Cove and Newbridge on the Charles. These two independent senior communities offer natural surroundings, lively programs, and a full spectrum of choices. You can see which community is more like you at hslindependentliving.org. And Grogan & Company, fine art auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988. Located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at groganco.com.
I'm Jim Browdy. Oops, I am Jim Browdy, and she is Emily Rooney. It still is Boston Public Radio. Yesterday, Emily and I had a bit of a set too, I guess you'd say, about the role of government in protection of us from ourselves, you know, smoking, obesity, that sort of stuff. I said, particularly when it's about kids, I'm in the Bloomberg School. She said she was not. Well, there's a new article in the Scientific American that actually just came out on Monday. Tread lightly. I'm so excited I can almost not read this. Labels that translate calories into walking distance could induce people to eat less. And the notion is here, you know, a lot of these chains by law and also voluntarily in some cases are saying, larger chains, how many calories, she's frowning at me, how many calories are in a soda or a cheeseburger or whatever. Well, these people in this study are suggesting that rather than calories, which are sort of an abstract thing, if you said to Jim Browdy or Emily Rooney that a 20-ounce soda has 240 calories, doesn't mean much. But if you told them the average 160-pound adult would have to walk 3 miles to burn that soda off, in Boston, by the way, that would mean walking from the north end to Kenmore Square, that would have an impact. I am in total agreement with these people.
These menus
you are, not.
Are going to be the size of Moby Dick. We're not going to be able to read through them. So, Jim, when you go into a restaurant and the basket of bread arrives.
Yeah.
You dip right in?
I inhale it. Yes, I do.
And what about, do you like olives?
I love olives.
Do you like eat the whole bowl with the olive
oil? I usually
oil
eat the whole bowl and then ask for another one and then I eat another one.
Me too.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, now where's the calorie counter there? My point is this is ridiculous.
No, it's not ridiculous.
They're just giving you one item at a time. Really, they're not giving you a total look at what's available. They never count stuff like that. They don't count anything
Can I
that's
tell you something?
Actually on the table.
And I didn't
the butter isn't counted.
Well, I didn't do this for this purpose. Yesterday, I'm embarrassed to say that I was at the Watertown – not I'm embarrassed to say I was at the Watertown Registry of Motor Vehicles. But as I was leaving, I was hungry. And I went to something – this is the embarrassing – either Domino's or something because I was starving. Well, I'm sorry. I did what I did. This is
you could have gone to Striptease.
This
that's
is,
right there.
Who?
Striptease.
What is Striptease?
That's the best food right
Striptease?
There in the mall. Yeah.
I didn't know that. But I literally ordered something that I didn't want. Because the calorie count on what I did want was about 200 calories higher. So that's one example. But I'm telling you, I totally buy this. If you knew, putting aside the logistics for a second, how do you do this so that the menu is not, you know, the size of the Hindenburg? If you knew that drinking that soda to offset the calorie count of that soda, you would have to walk 3 miles. You don't think it would cause people to think a second time?
No, I think most people would want the menu without the calorie counters on it because they don't want to be bothered reading that kind of stuff.
That's why we're the second fattest nation on earth. And if you want to deal with the problem – and by the way, this is not a government mandate. This – well, it could be. This is a public education campaign, the exact kind of thing you were talking about yesterday. Tell people what the consequences of their behavior are, either in terms of calories or, I think more importantly, walking distance. It's great.
Let me ask you something.
Yeah.
When you read those calorie things next to it, do you believe that? I have,
well, that's
I
a whole other issue. That's true.
How they can, you know, like a taco or a taco salad. It's like, how in the H do they know how many calories are in that? It's impossible. And it also depends on, you know, how much stuff you add to it, how much extra cheese.
That's
it's
true.
Like they have absolutely no clue. I guarantee you they don't know within 1,000 calories.
Well, first of all, I don't know if that's true, but I'm telling this walking distance thing. I mean, for example, the thing I ended up having at I don't know if it was Domino's, wherever it was that I went yesterday, it turns out I would have had to walk to Ohio
offset. That's the thing that people really need to know. If you have a cheeseburger or something like that and you get on one of those stationary bikes or whatever – You've got to ride that bike for about 24 hours.
So you think this is a good idea?
No, it's a terrible idea. It's discouraging.
Exactly. As well,
totally,
it should be.
No,
that's the whole point.
Discouraging for people who might want to get on the exercise bike because they're going to look at it and say, my gosh, I've got to go to Ohio before I wear up.
877-301-8970. You think this is a good idea? I've never heard of this before. I think it's a fabulous idea.
Stupid.
Again, this notion is that you put, excuse me, on menus the walking distance that would be required to offset the calorie intake of whatever it is you are doing. Again, the Freedom Trail. Here's another example. Walking the Freedom Trail would burn off, according to our colleagues, 16.6 ounces of soda. I'm telling you, if I saw
16?
That.
16? You'd be dying of thirst by the time you get
whatever,
done with the Freedom
all
Trail.
All I'm saying to you, well, you have water is the point. If the choice is, you'd prefer none of this. If the choice is
none.
Between calories, which are an abstract notion, I don't think the average person knows how many calories is supposed to have a day anyway to maintain their weight. But
do you?
Well, I think it's, yeah, sort of, like 2,500 or or something like that. But if it turns out you were told what you would have to do, what physical behaviors you would have to engage in to offset what you're doing, I do think it would have an impact. And Emily, what's the downside? Even if it didn't work all the time, if you
because
have more –
Because it's not meaningful. Because what you would have to walk is different from what I would have to walk. And people are going to get – we're obsessed by stuff like this. It's not helpful. What's helpful is – being informed about decent nutrition and what's – and you know
working
what, you know
well,
what, Jim?
Isn't it?
It's all about freaking portion control. That's
I agree
the
with that.
Whole deal in a nutshell.
You ever been to the Cheesecake Factory?
No.
You could feed a country, a small country with one on.
There's
no,
a
it's a real
I don't
problem.
Go. I have like food phobia. I've told you about this. It's like I could never go on one of those cruises. Too much food. It would make me nervous. You know, there's like mounds and mounds and mounds. I don't like going to weddings or buffets when you see these, because all I can think about is how much they're going to throw out or how much I'm going to eat.
Exactly. 877-301-8970. How about this approach? Again, that the labels on these products or the menus say what the walking distance is for an average weight person. You hear in the background, Emily Reed is going, stupid, stupid. Let's take a couple of calls and see if I win this one today. Pete, you're in Ashland. You're on with Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy, and we're talking about a different approach to the nation's public health problems. Hi, Pete.
Hey, just wanted to say the way they figure out the amount of calories in foods isn't really magic or anything. It literally translates to how much energy you get if you were literally to burn that food. Mm. But also, what I wanted to say is I think the kind of visualization idea of how far you'd have to walk or how many sit-ups or whatever you would need to do is pretty useful in terms of basically giving you an idea of if you want to stay at a certain weight or lose weight or gain weight. I mean, it tells you in an easy to understand way what you need to expend to basically just exactly. make sure you don't turn into a Jabba the Hutt.
I couldn't agree with you more, Pete. You said it beautifully. Thank you so much.
Jim's winning already.
What about that? Well, after yesterday, I had to win one. What about that? I mean, he basically, it paints a picture for
not
you.
Not meaningful.
You know, Emily, you know what it's like? And I hate to make this comparison, but I'm going to do it anyway. When people say, we're talking about gun control, Todd Zwillick earlier this morning in Washington, when the opponents of assault weapons say, well, the guy in Aurora would have gotten the assault weapon anyway. The guy in Newtown would have gotten the assault weapon anyway. Well, maybe, just maybe, he wouldn't. Well, to bring it to another level, maybe this is going to have an impact on somebody who's got a weight problem. You do acknowledge we have a huge obesity problem in this country.
I just don't
think. So what's the solution?
I don't know. I also, you know, when you go into a restaurant, is that really the first thing you want to be thinking about is how many calories I am just? Most of us don't eat in restaurants every day anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You cook at home, and then you're not even looking. You know, you're throwing the butter in instead of the oleo or whatever. It's like, and as long as this is not required, it's all voluntary on the parts of the restaurants, fine, go ahead. Then I can skip those restaurants. But, you know, if we're going to start passing laws, you have to, you know, do a calorie count and a walk count.
You would avoid a restaurant that you would
yes.
otherwise want to go to
yes.
because the menu
yes,
had walking distance information and calories?
Very annoying. That's not the first thing I want to look at when I open the menu. Oh, you have this ribeye steak and you're going to be walking. No, I don't want to see it.
What if it turns out, here's another option, then we'll get back to the calls at 877-301-8970. What if they had next to the worst items on the menu a drawing of a profile of Alfred Hitchcock, for example? Would that be something if they had a stick figure next to
well,
some people?
It's like the cigarettes with the lungs. I mean, I didn't
You're
even go
against that too?
No, I was not for that. I wasn't. I mean, we all know that cigarettes give you lung cancer, but you don't have to put a photograph of it on the package.
It's worked in Canada pretty well. You know, it really has worked in Canada pretty
that.
Well. Let's go to Dana. I think Dana and Brewster, you're next with Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy. We're talking about this walking distance thing on menus or placards or something. Hi, Dana.
Hi, thank you. As someone who's most likely going to have a hot fudge sundae this afternoon and is fat, I've got a pot belly, I am all for it because I think if we're going to eat stuff like this, and we are, we should do it mindfully so we are reminded of what we're doing and maybe gauge our exercise accordingly. I'm pretty active. I exercise.
You said
you're
fat.
Yeah, so
why
really
are you even going to have the sundae? Why are you thinking about that now? You should skip the sundae, and then
you
can skip the walk.
Like St. Paul says, the good I would do, I do not. The evil I would not do, I do. That's the human condition. But and I'm working on it, but it's not easy. And
but Dana, stop for a second. Dana, if it turns out, on a semi-serious note, if when you went in for that hot fudge sundae this afternoon, it said you would have to walk from the Friendlies you're going to or whatever to Foxwoods, to would that have an impact on whether you had it or not?
It might start, yeah. It might plant the seeds. I mean, change takes time. I can't turn on a dime, no, but yeah.
I agree with you.
You
Dana,
know?
Beautifully
yeah.
put. Thanks, Dana.
So,
no, he said it beautifully.
Nothing.
He did. You're keeping score, so am I.
Yeah.
Let's try another one. Go
I
ahead.
Won every one yesterday.
What's that?
I
you
won
did, indeed. But today's
yeah.
a new day.
It
Kristen
is.
In Westford, you're on with Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy. Hey, Kristen. Hi, Kristen.
So I've got to say, I love Jim's idea. You could tweak it a little bit, though. Have the menu with the calorie counts next to it. But then as kind of public education, also, I don't know if you require it or just get restaurants to like the idea of it, but to have a poster representing exactly what Jim is saying. So if you ate 250 calories, you would need to walk 3 miles.
You want a poster in a restaurant?
Yeah. Well, then if someone's not looking at the menu with all this information, you're going to walk. Because most, all right, so here's where my idea comes from. So finally, after 4 years of not losing the baby weight, I decided I'm going about this all wrong. I need to start counting calories. So I did. I went in exactly like Jim said earlier. I went to a Panera, looked up at the board. I said, that's what I really want. But oh, my gosh, that has 670 calories. I'm going to get the soup and a half sandwich, and it was 420 calories.
Okay.
And then later on, I went to the gym and got on the elliptical, and after 40 minutes, I had burned 350 calories. So now this is starting to be put, after weeks and weeks of doing this, being put into perspective of, okay, I know what I'm eating, I know what the calorie counts are, and now I know based on my workout what I can eat during the day to maintain an average of 2,000 calories a day, which is probably what I need for a woman my height, my age, blah, blah, blah.
No, but what's, let's say you walked into Toscano on Charles Street. Would you want the same poster there?
No, probably not, but...
But can I tell you, Kristen, I can help you out here. I can help you out. Forget poster.
Okay, go ahead.
There is some fast food joint I was in a couple of weeks ago, and it may have been Dunkin' Donuts, where the calorie count, forget the how far you have to walk, is not on the menu on the wall. There's a little flyer that you choose to get or not get. There's a little sign on the wall. It says if you want to know calorie counts or some such information, ask the manager, ask the something. And then you can go take this thing. So it isn't in your face, as Emily's talking about a minute ago, but it's sort of a side thing, which if you want, you take. And if you don't want, you don't take. So that's the perfect solution.
And, you know, I think you start to form an idea of what the calories are going to be in specific foods. So, yes, you walk into a nice restaurant and you start to gauge things based on what you're eating during the day. Now, I'm on the road all the time. I'm into a lot of fast food places. I'm into McDonald's and Panera's, and I'm getting this grilled chicken sandwich with alpha mayo, just, you know, taking off some of the bread.
Perfect.
And why do you go to fast food places?
Because I'm on the road all day long, I can't bring my lunch to work, and I don't want to sit down for a nice restaurant to spend a fortune for lunch.
Kristen, leave it right there. You crushed Emily bug. It was perfect, and I don't think
she
you have to go any further.
Habits.
Kristen, thank you. By the way, I do the
eating habits.
I do the exact same thing at Panera that she does all the time. I get this. Emily's making it. Where's the camera? Emily's
making
a face.
I've never been to Panera.
Where have you been? What kind of thing other than Toscano?
Well, I bring my lunch.
You do bring your lunch?
Yeah.
What
so
do you do?
My Marjorie brings yours.
Yeah, sometimes she does. You know what I'm going to do, actually? I'm going to come into your office tomorrow when you have a lunch.
Yeah.
I'm put a little sign on it for
okay,
the number
good.
Of calories now before you have to walk. Let's try one more here. Let's go.
Yeah, let's go to Elaine.
Hey, Elaine.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hello. I think that's the walking distance thing is the silliest thing I've heard all day.
Bingo.
Okay, go ahead. Why?
I am overweight. I know darn well what I'm putting in my mouth sometimes probably isn't all that great, but I choose to do it. As an adult, I think if you want to educate kids about that kind of thing, that's great. I just don't see the benefit at all. I think people really do know when they're doing the wrong thing. They're making a choice.
But it's a matter of degrees, Elaine. Just like you heard the woman who called a minute ago, Kristen, say, go to Panera. I was going to get X, and I decided to get Y instead. And the other point you're making, which I wish I had made and tried to make yesterday, the most important thing is the kids. They can't make the decisions for themselves. And so if you have all this information that we're talking about here, and it's available for a parent to talk to their kid about, that can have a positive impact, right?
Yep, I think so. But I don't think it should be in restaurants. If I go out to a restaurant, now fast food I don't really consider.
Food.
A restaurant.
Well, yeah. I'm talking about some place where you go in and sit down. I just that's not the experience I want to have. I understand what I'm doing when I walk in there. It's very different. There's a lot of information out there for people. I think it should be a choice, but I don't think it should be in people's faces.
See, I do. Elaine, thank you so
much. Fast food only,
Jim. For the call.
Fast food restaurants only.
Well, chains. I mean, I frankly do. It's very difficult, I think, in a single location place for them to do the calculation. So I'd be sensitive to that. But short of that, every place that can do it without huge cost, I think the answer is they should do it. I'm moving you on this.
You won.
I can see, right? I did win, didn't I?
You did win today.
I'm not gloating at all, am I?
One all.
We'll see what happens the next day. Okay, what's coming up?
All right, up next is Open Mic. Can't wait. Boston Globe editor Brian McGrory is here for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH.
If you recently earned a college degree, you know how astronomical the cost of education is today.
Nobody would deny that we have a college cost problem in this country, but it's a complicated problem, and usually the sound bites don't quite capture the complexity.
We'll look at those complexities when we talk about the future of college on Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Check it out Thursday night at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Alston community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And the law firm of Wolf Greenfield. Specializing in intellectual property law, Wolf Greenfield provides clients with solutions on patents, trademarks, licensing, and litigation. WolfGreenfield.com.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Emily Rooney. Joining us, as he does every Wednesday on Open Mic at 1 o'clock, is the editor of the Boston Globe and the author of Buddy, How a Rooster. It's a great book, Emily.
I love that book.
How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. That particular family man would be Brian McGorry. Hello, Brian.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Emily. How are you?
Hey, Brian. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So listen, I, for one, cannot get enough of the story of the Gardner Museum heist, and I particularly appreciate your coverage today with that little culprit diagram. I loved it.
Did you do the interactive diagram online?
I did.
Isn't that great?
I did.
I could play with that for about 2 hours.
Wait, I didn't. What is the interactive diagram?
You didn't even see it this morning.
I didn't see it. What is it, Brian?
So you have this whole, quite literally, a ring of potential thieves, really suspects, so the lawyers don't call me, but people who've been mentioned as people of interest in the Gardner heist, and they're all in a circle, in a ring, and you just click on them, mm-hmm. and you get the whole story about who they are and why they've been looked at. And you realize very quickly that most people in this case, virtually everybody actually, are either dead, in jail, or missing.
Or dying.
Yeah.
All right, so here's my question, Brian. Do you and the FBI have the exact same suspects? And if you do, why not just say so?
Well, we don't. Here's the problem with that, Emily, and I agree it's a little bit maddening from the tone of your voice. I think you find it
very frustrating.
They're not telling us. And it's, they came out in this press conference, which was a stunner, two days ago, and said, well, we know who did it. We believe we know who did it. And then the FBI investigator said in today's paper, you know, we have the whodunit part of this solved. It's where the paintings are that we're unclear of. They lost the trail going back 10 years. So they won't tell us. And that's the frustrating part. We believe.
So you haven't cut a deal with the FBI to hold back because of compromise of the investigation.
We don't have any deal with them. Yeah. I mean, for God's sakes, no. We don't have any deal. We're trying to get the names. And we think that the names we have published in print are the people they are looking at, because it's where they've the lawns that they've dug up in the central part of Massachusetts and Connecticut. We think we're, tracking who is involved in the Philadelphia mob and, who has ties to Connecticut. So we are mentioning the people who we believe they are looking at because it's simply common sense. But there is no deal with the FBI and the Globe on this. No.
Do you buy the notion that they actually do know who these people are? I mean, I wasn't persuaded yesterday on the radio or watching TV that they had a good reason for not disclosing the names of the people who they were. The only reason I could come up with, other than sort of the boilerplate, we're in the midst of an investigation, can't disclose anything, is they're not really 100% sure.
It would be odd that they came out as confidently as they did and not know. I mean, look, we've all, playing the role of reporters, we've all bluffed a little bit in our day, pretending we knew stuff that we didn't, just to harness more information. That would be a pretty bold bluff. We think that they are working off a series of tips, one of the which was initiated in 2010, which has been particularly fruitful for them. So my gut is that they do know, or they do believe they have the right people, some of whom are, like we said, either dead or in confinement right now.
So if you can confirm their names, you'll print them.
Oh, God, yeah. We printed names already, Emily,
yeah.
Because we think those are the people they're talking about. No, we are working. We have three reporters on this, three of our very best reporters. Steve Kirkchin, a three-time Pulitzer Prize winner, retired from the Globe, has been working this for us. I think he knows more about the Gardner Museum heist than anybody in America who doesn't work at the Gardner Museum. Shelley Murphy, who is as well-sourced in this town as any other reporter, and Milton Valencia, a hot young reporter in this town who, you know, we're working this hard. We're working this very, very hard.
So can I discuss with you, Brian, the other huge event in Boston this week? And I'm going to actually quote from a columnist from your paper when the event happened, I guess, 7 years ago. This is from his column. I'm begging anyone in South Boston with any sense, anyone on Beacon Hill who might hold sway, for the sake of the city and the name of self-preservation, put an end to the annual St. Patrick's Day breakfast. It's a tradition that has woefully outlived its time. And here's the last line. Schindler's List was funnier than this year's affair. Do you know who wrote that, Brian?
You don't see writing that good in the Globe anymore, do you? Do you?
So 7 years after the fact, is it time to call it quits, Brian McGroy?
You were there, Jim.
I was. I was the television. You didn't even watch, did you?
Here's what I did. I went on.
No, you didn't.
Honest to God, I did, and this is kind of pathetic, but I went on Neckin's website. You had exclusive rights
to
air this, and I went on and watched. You did it very... Nicely,
thank you.
You divided it up by each person's appearance on the stage, and one was worse than the other. I mean, my God, you were there. How bad was it? Was it worse in person?
I would say, I have to be candid, I have not watched the replay on NECN.com. In person, it was relatively painful. It was dreadful, actually. And it just doesn't have that thing anymore. And, you know, one of the reasons why, at least to me, it became even clearer the other day about how dreadful it was, is you had memories of Weld, who did an odd couple of songs there, Weld and Bulger, which was when the breakfast was great many, many years ago. Guys who had formerly been at Loggerheads and then became best buds and were really witty and really fast. So in any case,
even Weld, I didn't think was good at.
No, he was. It was like all amber all the time. Is my sense. I don't know that for a fact, but I didn't think his heart was in it, frankly. And I'm not even clear why he was there.
No, you do remember back to the day of. I mean, say what you will about Bill Bulger, but guy could have been a professional game show host.
It was so funny.
I mean, it was hilarious.
It was sharp.
And 90% of it was ad-libs. For those who haven't watched those earlier breakfasts, very little of it was scripted. It was just him reacting to everybody on the stage.
He would play off to somebody who walked in the room.
And he could just glide from one topic, one person to another effortlessly. This was just every seam showed. It just was work all the way through. And it goes on for, what did it go on, 10, 15 hours?
No, it actually went for 2 hours and 37 minutes, but who's counting? But most importantly, to wrap this up, you thought that I presented it nicely. Was that your word?
Nicely.
Well, here's what happens when you watch it on Neckin.com. You get none of Jim Browdy.
Is that true?
All you get is the appearances at the microphone. I was just watching to see you, Jim. That was the only reason I was clicking.
You just see the look on his face.
You know what I'll do? I'll send you the tape later today, Brian. You can watch it again.
Well, you did already, Jim. I have it sitting here on my desk, so I appreciate that.
Brian, on a slightly dicier subject, understand there's something of work action going on at the Globe. There was some kind of a silent walk the other day. Some of the union members walked by the editorial meeting and some other executive offices. The issue being that people want a contract there before there's any kind of a formal sale of the Globe. So they're pushing Chris Mayer to sign a new contract.
The publisher.
Right?
Yeah.
What did he say?
He's a man of few words, Brian McGroy.
I'm waiting.
Is that accurate? Is there a work action going on at the Globe?
I mean, there was what you described. There is a contract negotiation going on. So far, I think it's heading in the right direction. I'm not involved in the negotiations. I understand the union is trying to get as much as they can, which any union should, and these people work hard. And, you know, look at it. Reporters aren't paid, editors aren't paid, photographers aren't paid nearly as well as they should be. And designers and everybody else in here. It's a tough business right now. And, you know, as I try to avoid this negotiation in here and this line of inquiry with you, I just hope this gets resolved in a way that benefits everybody.
Is it necessary, do you think, to have this resolved before the sale, or would a new buyer prefer that it not be?
It's an interesting question. It's one that, the people in the front office here in the union have to weigh. I don't know, from an I say from an outside point of view, I'm not in the union, but I would think that everybody might feel a little more secure if things were buttoned down by the time a new owner came into place. But if they decide they're not getting the deal they want, they can roll the dice and see what happens coming in. I don't know. I mean, from my point of view, at a relatively uncertain time as we await a new owner, I would love to see a contract resolved. These are good people in here. They work hard. And it's not as if the place is just soaked in money that they're withholding. In the front office is just not enough of it right now because everybody knows the industry trends. I just hope that this can be resolved to the benefit of everybody before we get sold.
Brian, am I wrong to read into your tone? We're talking to Brian McGrory, the editor of The Globe. It sounded in the last 60 seconds like it wasn't an if, but a when and who in terms of the sale. Is that a fair description?
Oh, yeah. I've always said that, Jim. I mean, I the New York Times wants to sell us, and right now it's good market to sell newspapers. The industry has, hit bottom 4 years ago or so. Now it's on the rise to some extent. I mean, it's not like we're, rolling in dough here, like I just said, but it's a stable industry. The place is making is cash positive, to use the parlance of the front office. So I think, I'm hearing of a lot of interest in this town in terms of people who might want to buy the paper.
Well, one of those people, as you know, is Aaron Kushner, who's often described simply as a wealthy businessman.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know that he's emerged in this.
His name has popped up a couple times. It's disappeared and come around in a circle a couple times. He recently said, and you've been quoted as saying, and it's kind of an old line in the newspaper business, that it's our job to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And Aaron Kushner said, actually, no, I don't see that. If I were, in that kind of a role, I don't see that as being my job. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think he might have said that at a public meeting, and I was reading over what he said after the fact, and I think I don't mean to speak for Aaron Kushner. I've never met him. I don't know the guy. If he walked into my office here, I would have no idea who he was. I think he meant that it's not the role of a paper to afflict a community. And I may or may not agree with that. I haven't thought about it enough. I do think that there are two mantras that we have in the newspaper business. One is to afflict the comfortable and to comfort the afflicted. The other is to give voice to those who wouldn't otherwise have one. And I think the Globe has done that, both of those, very, very well for a long, long time. And I'm not paying too much attention to what Aaron is doing out in Orange County. I'm just paying attention to what we do here at the Globe, and I'm pretty happy with it.
Speaking of what you do here at the Globe, there are a bunch of people, Canellis, Resendez, Cook, Abraham, Lehigh, the list is far longer, who now work at the Globe, who obviously started their careers, or at least had a piece of their career at the Boston Phoenix. What was your reaction to the news the other day, Brian? What kind of hole do you think it leaves in the landscape here?
I mean, it's really sad to see the Phoenix go. It gave birth to so many fantastic writers here in Boston. You've listed a few around the country as well. Jenna Maslin at the New York Times started at the Phoenix. I mean, the list goes on and on. It does leave a big hole. I mean, the Phoenix, hasn't been the Phoenix of its heyday, I think, in a little while, although they still have terrific reporters who did really important work in this town, including on politics, covering the underclass. Anytime you see a newspaper depart, it's a sad thing. But the Phoenix in particular served a vital role in the community, and we're not as good a city without the Phoenix around.
Do you sit down the next day with your team and say, now that the Phoenix is gone, there's a piece of what they did that we should incorporate in the Boston Globe? Did that happen, or will that happen?
Yeah, I mean, I hope we do some of that already, Jim. I hope I hope some of the things they were covering very well, and they were covering them very well, Beacon Hill and the whole movement, the 99% movement, the Occupy Wall Street movement, they did very well at. I think we did reasonably well, too. They might have gone at it with a sharper edge. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're always looking at such a mealy-mouthed answer I'm about to give, but we're always looking at what we can do better. But, in light of the Phoenix, it causes you to reassess a bit about what you do.
Can I give you one more opportunity for another mealy-mouthed answer? If you
I love
mind,
that. I mean, how many mealy-mouthed answers have I given in this short conversation?
Actually,
it's great.
Only
pretty good
at the
today.
End. Jerry Leone, the Middlesex DA, sort of the Elliot Ness, I think a lot of people think, Marjorie always calls him that, of prosecutors, not only is not running for re-election, which we knew, but he's leaving on, I think it's April 29th, I may have the date wrong, to join the same firm that Scott Brown chose to join last week. Do you find that odd, Brian McGorry?
I do find it a little odd. I would think that, how long is, I should know this answer, how long is a term of a DA?
4 years. I'm pretty sure it's 4 years. Yeah. In reality, it's only eight more months till it's over in January.
I wonder if they just, if Nixon Peabody said we have an opening now that may not be here in 8 months. I don't quite understand that.
He's got kids going to prep school or something.
I just think you could have lasted 8 months longer in the role. You've got some pretty significant cases that are outstanding, including the one of the nanny who...
Yeah.
Has not been charged with murder yet, but they kind of made that clear a couple of months ago when they, you know, unfurled that case. So I'm a little bit surprised about this. I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but it does seem unusual.
And Deval Patrick gets to make the appointment, not unlike he did with the Senate seat. And there are rumors in town that Gabriel Gomez is going to apply for the job. You think that's? I guess not. You don't think that.
I'm going to leave that one alone.
Thank you. Brian McGorry, it's been a pleasure as always. Editor of the Globe, he joins us every Wednesday at 1 o'clock on Open Mic. Brian, good to talk to you.
Jim, great talking to you, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
All right, so what is football,
Grant?
Drew Bledsoe taking on Beacon Hill. What's he tackling up there? He'll tell you what he's up to next on Boston Public Radio.
The program you're enjoying right now is primarily paid for by listener support. And thousands of WGBH supporters double the impact of their gifts by having them matched dollar for dollar by their employers. To find out if your employer will stand with you in supporting WGBH radio and television, visit wgbh.org/matchinggifts.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Emily Rooney. One of the finest quarterbacks of his time is now one of the finest winemakers. But unless something is done, people here may never know. Joining us is the guy who runs the Double Back Winery. He's on the phone from New York City. Good afternoon, Drew Bledsoe.
Hey, how you doing today?
Excellent. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, Drew. It's Emily Rooney. So what? What'd you make of Wes? Oh, I guess we're not talking about. Sorry. All right. Wine. So no, seriously.
We can talk.
We will. We'll get into that. So is this another one of those arcane Massachusetts laws? Because I think we're one of 16 states that prohibit the direct shipping of wine from out of state to residents in state. And this bill that you're lobbying, would it just apply to online shipping, or would it be any kind of shipping? Like if I was out in California,
can I ship myself a case? We're talking specifically about wine.
No, I meant online.
Not spirits.
No, I understand. No. My question was, is it online, not wine, online shipping?
Online shipping. Online shipping, or, anybody that places an order would be able to order and receive wine in Massachusetts. And what we're really talking about is just it's a law that's already been ruled as unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court 3 years ago, I think it was. And it's fair. It's fair to the consumer. It's fair to the winery, and ultimately, it's fair to the state. By one estimate, there's one estimate out there that could be as much as $50 million in tax revenue to the state.
My question: if I go out to your winery, the Double Back Winery out in Washington State, and I ship myself a case of wine, is that legal?
I believe that is still illegal. I believe it is still illegal, even if you buy it there and then take it down and ship it. Now, of course, you can put it in an unmarked box and. But not that anybody would ever consider going around the law that way. But
hey, Drew Bledsoe, we were trying to figure out what is the argument against someone sitting in their house or their office, going online to your website, deciding they want to order wine. What is the argument that your opponents are making? I just don't get this at all.
So there are a couple of arguments against. Neither one of them has much merit, quite honestly. One is to protect the distributors and package stores. And the reason that one doesn't hold up, there are a couple reasons. Number one, you're talking about 1% of total wine sales in the United States go direct from the winery to the consumer. So you're only talking about 1% of total wine sales. And the other thing that we've seen both anecdotally with our business, but also in one study that was done in Maryland, is that wine sales actually increase for distributors and package stores when the state opens to direct shipping. It just helps to develop a wine culture and make that more pervasive, and the stores end up doing better. So that's one argument is, you know, you're protecting the package stores and the distributors, but I don't think that one has much merit. The other one is that some people have tried to, make the argument for is safety and protecting, you know, the minors from alcohol. But that one falls pretty flat pretty quickly, because when you're talking about fine wine, if you're a 16-year-old, you're not going to go online, order some wine, and wait a week for it to show up so you can drink expensive wine. You know, just that argument doesn't really hold much water.
By the way,
go ahead.
The legislation, in case people want to call some of their legislators on this, is House Bill 294, and I believe if people call in to lobby for this, you will come to their backyard and throw a football around with their kid. Is that correct?
Bring a bottle of wine.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. You call in and give your legislator a nudge, and I will show up at your house. I'll bring pizza and we'll throw a football around.
Hey, Drew, you seem, from what I read this morning, you started doing this wine thing while you were still playing football. I don't know if it was with the Bills, the Cowboys, whoever it was. What's with you? Where are the roots in you of this wine business? Where did this come from?
Yeah, so it's kind of a fun story, because it's not a dumb jock makes some money and goes into the wine business story. It's a story about, you know, a local boy from Walla Walla, Washington that goes off and has some success and then comes back home to his old hometown to start a business. I was able to come back. My winemaker, it was literally my next door neighbor when I was growing up, from the time I was in about sixth grade. So it's a really authentic story about coming back to my hometown. That's where the name comes back for our winery. It's why it's called Double Back. I doubled back and came back home.
Well, so Drew, do you do a good business with other states who don't have this kind of onerous law? Do you do a lot of shipping directly to residents? Why are you coming into Massachusetts? We're, as I said, we're only one of 16
states.
Well,
yeah, a couple of reasons. Yeah, we do. I'm in New York City today working with our distributor down here to go, see some restaurants and pour some wine around. And our distributor down here does a very nice business with our wine, and we also direct ship a lot of wine to New York State. But, you know, the reason specifically that Massachusetts is important, number one, I think Massachusetts is the seventh largest wine-consuming state in the country.
Wow.
Is that
certainly
true?
The largest wine.
Your neighborhood, Jim.
Don't hold me to that. I could be wrong, but I think it's certainly – Massachusetts is definitely the largest wine-consuming state that doesn't allow direct shipping. Mm. So when you start talking about these small mom-and-pop wineries, which we kind of consider ourselves to be, that's pretty significant. You got people that, even if it's, just, you know, 40 or 50 people that want to buy wine, that becomes fairly significant to a small winery. And then you talk about those wineries in general, but then you also talk specifically about our winery, about Double Back. You know, I mean, Tom Brady wanted to buy some wine from me a few years ago and couldn't do it. You know, I ended up shipping the wine to his dad, and I think his dad drank it all. But
so Drew Bledsoe,
go ahead.
Would you prefer, if you had a choice between facing a 380-pound lineman or having to lobby a legislator, which would you choose?
You know, this is my first experience with lobbying, so I'll have to get back to you on that after my day tomorrow.
Actually coming tomorrow. You're coming to Massachusetts tomorrow to do some lobbying, right?
I am, yep. I'll be up there first thing in the morning.
You have some bipartisan support. You got Ted Spiliotis. He's a Democrat from Danvers. Bradley Jones, as we all know, Republican from North Reading.
Yep.
So you've already got bipartisan support on this bill. You're pretty hopeful?
Absolutely. I mean, they can't get bipartisan support for much these days. So we consider ourselves lucky that at least we can agree on some fine wine.
What about the liquor industry? Are they going to be lobbying pretty hard against this, Marty's and those guys?
I don't know who we're facing there, but this one's pretty simple. It's pretty cut and dried. Supreme Court's already ruled. The legislation's been written. All it takes, honestly, is just a vote.
Okay, final.
Once that's voted on, we'll be good to go.
We know you got to go. Speaking of going, last question: if the law passes, and Emily Rooney and I support the law's passage, what do we get from the Double Back Winery, Drew Bledsoe?
Well, you get the right to go online and buy some.
What's your finest thing, by the way?
We get this thing done. I'll swing by and bring some wine with me, and we'll sip on some while we're on the radio.
What did you think of Wes Welker's departure? While I've got you.
Oh man, I was bummed to see Wes go. I think everybody was. Man, he's been such a great patriot for so many years, and I know Tommy's bummed to see him going on down the road. I know Mr. Kraft is bummed to see him leaving. It was a sad day. I do, selfishly for Wes, I think he'll have a great year out in Denver. I think that's one of the best situations he could have landed in if he wasn't going to be with the Patriots. So, sad day, but I know Wes will do well.
Can they buy wine online in Colorado?
Yeah, you can in Colorado. Absolutely.
Hey, Drew Bledsoe, good luck. We really appreciate your time. It's House Bill 294.
Hey, thanks for the time, guys.
Drew Bledsoe.
Thanks for the time, guys. Yeah, I'll look forward to being up there in my old stomping grounds in Boston tomorrow.
We'll be looking forward to seeing it. Drew Bledsoe, live from New York. He's in town tomorrow lobbying for this change in law, which seems totally reasonable to me. Joining us in studio to answer the question about whether or not we really are the seventh largest wine-consuming state in the country is the founder of the Boston Wine School, Jonathan Alsop. Is that true, Jonathan?
I believe we are the seventh largest per capita consumer.
Yeah. I don't think in terms of that, sounds right.
It's still a big deal. And what Drew said before is regardless, and not to correct you, I believe we're one of 11 states.
We're 16.
So, I mean,
what's the argument? Is there an argument against this?
You know what? There is no argument against this. This is a remnant of the compromise that was struck in 1933 when Prohibition went away. When Prohibition went away, the compromise was that liquor control would devolve to the lowest municipality. This is still why you have, you know, Wellesley partially dry, Dismal Seepage, Kentucky completely dry, all of these different places. You're allowed to legislate down to the lowest municipal level. The states of our nation said, you know, bingo, bonus, and each state became like its own little country controlling the import and export. In some ways, before – even today, if you want to sell your wine in a retail way in Massachusetts, even if you're making wine in Washington State or Oregon or California or some part of the U.S., you have to have in some ways a Massachusetts – I mean, it's crazy, but an importer who receives your wine, you know, physically –
because of this law,
clerically, because of this law,
I can't go down to the Westport winery and buy a case of wine.
Westport, you can. There's a separate law for mass wineries that makes them both producers, retailers, and distributors. They can also wholesale their wine themselves to restaurants and liquor stores and wine shops in Massachusetts.
Have you ever tasted any of Bledsoe's wine?
I have not, but
I've read really good things about it.
If a wine that costs $90 a bottle is not delicious, what kind of world are we living in? You know, it must be great.
But don't you think there are going to be some people lobbying against this? I mean, the big liquor.
Yes,
Yes. Well, retail, they don't like it. They don't want anybody buying their alcohol by the case, in their stores.
And as always, whether it's film, whether it's video, whether it's music, the old form always resists the new form. And this is a new form of doing business and a new form of reaching wine lovers. And the old forms are saying, we've never heard of this. We don't do this. We don't like this. It's typical. It happened in, as I said, it happened in music. It happened in film. And it's just, I mean, I think they're losing money by resisting this model. Who is in a better position to ship and deliver wine directly to consumers than an already established distributor, importer, retailer?
Well, it's also a huge amount of tax dollars, all this sort of stuff.
It's like money on the table.
Hey, Jonathan Alsop, I've actually wanted to meet you because one of the things I was dying to ask you, which I will now, is I was bar mitzvahed at age 13.
Okay.
So I've not been back to synagogue very much, but occasionally I do a Passover thing.
Yes.
Passover's coming up next. Is there such a thing as a good Passover wine?
Yes. Yes, there
that
are.
That is not sweet as sugar?
You're talking about. So the association you're making is Manischewitz.
I am.
Mogen David. You know, these traditional.
It's like mouthwash.
Yeah, they're very sweet. They're Concord grape.
Thick.
You know, they're not wine grape, traditional wine grape wines. When it comes to wines that are kosher or kosher for Passover, a lot of Israeli wines are really, really spectacular. Reconati is a great Israeli wine. We would pronounce this Dalton. It looks just like the English name Dalton, but in Hebrew it's pronounced Dalton.
Mm-hmm.
Great wines from Galilee. That really is the way to go. I think what you're looking for are wines that are kosher because that's just the way they are. You know, not kosher as a marketing concept.
Tell the truth. Have you ever had a whole
theme.
Glass of Mogen David or one of those things? That's really hard to take, isn't it?
How big's a glass?
Yeah.
It really is tough.
I've had a whole little itty-bitty teeny-tiny glass of it.
Like a thimble kind of thing. When I was a kid, did you ever try that,
sure.
Emily?
For sure.
Horrible, right?
Awful.
When I was a kid, I loved it.
Loved it. You know what? It's these kinds of sweet wines, white Zinfandel. You know, in the wine world, we think of these as gateway wines. You know, this is how we get people in.
Which is why you like it as a kid.
This is why,
it's like grape juice.
Exactly. We
it
get
like
people in, juice, yeah. And then we work them up to where they won't drink anything that they can afford, and then they're in a good place.
So is Drew Bledsoe right about this, that this is unconstitutional? This is just a matter of, you know, pushing the bill through?
Yes. Well, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled against all of these interstate commerce laws in 2005. And then the Supreme Judicial Court ruled specifically against our laws in 2008. So
why do we need a bill?
Well, because that's the way it is.
Jim likes those bills.
Didn't they have to do that on gay marriage when the SJC ruled with Margie Marshall, was here 2 days ago, that it was unconstitutional? Didn't the legislature then have to, they didn't have to do it?
No.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry I brought it up.
Yeah.
Now, are you sticking around for this wedding discussion?
Sure,
we're
absolutely.
That's terrific. What's coming up, Emily? Really?
We're going to have a wedding discussion. What do you think the average couple spends on a wedding?
I was stunned. Stunned. Tell them.
I was actually surprised it was this little.
Little?
27,000. That's a couple. That's before the parents start weighing in.
No honeymoon included, by the way,
exactly.
For 27,000.
All right, stay tuned for that discussion next on 89.7 WGBH Boston.
It's almost time to celebrate New Year's, Persian New Year's, that is. Our guest tells us how he's making the day a little more fly.
We blend, we mix the Iranian and the black culture together. So it's like having, I guess, like Kwanzaa and Nowruz at the same time.
We're talking Persian New Year with comedian Tehran Van Ghasri. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Harvard Innovation Lab, where entrepreneurs from across Harvard, the Austin community, Boston, and beyond engage in teaching and learning in pursuit of taking their innovative ideas to the world. ilab.harvard.edu. And WGBH 44, your new home for the best in public affairs. Friday nights catch the McLaughlin Group at 9, followed by Need to Know at 9:30 and Moyers & Company at 10. Lively debate and fresh insights, Friday on WGBH 44.
Love that song. You listen to Boston Public Radio with Emily Rooney and Jim Browdy. To get you in the mood for this discussion coming up, here's a clip from the film Father of the Bride.
This is fabulous.
Oh, that is incredible. Annie, that's just like the one we saw in the magazine. Mm-hmm. Do you like it, Dad?
Well, what is that? Is that dollars? $1,200?
Without my muscle banks, this is a very reasonable price for a cake of this magnitude.
A cake of Franck is made of flour and water. My first car didn't cost $1,200.
That was pretty funny. The latest number in Brides magazine, as Emily just said, suggests the average couple in this country spends nearly $27,000 on a wedding. Here with us to say how you can bring the number down and still have huge fun and great memories is Cheryl Marshall. She's the woman behind Everything Money. And Jonathan Alsop, the founder of the Boston Wine School, decided to stick around. Hello, Cheryl, and hello again, Jonathan.
Hello. Hey,
Cheryl.
Hello.
Hey, Emily thinks the 27 is low.
Wait, first of all, as I was driving in and listening to you the first thing that my ears heard was Emily saying, I hate weddings because there's too much food. Yeah. And I know for a fact that you are the mother of a marriage-eligible child. I don't know about you, Jim.
I got two. Okay. Not quite yet, but they're on
all
the
right.
way.
So I think that you should, excuse the expression, eat those words, okay? if you don't mind me saying it.
Well, let's start with what some of the big expenses
right.
are.
Well, I mean,
how does this happen?
Venue is probably the biggest expense. You know, many people get married at hotels. Then you have food. Then you've got invitations, the engagement ring. So, you know, it just goes
the dress,
okay. And by the way, that number does not include the honeymoon.
Right, 27 is honeymoon free.
Honeymoon free, okay.
How much was, since Jonathan's here, what percentage, roughly, of this average cost of a wedding is spent on booze, on liquor, on wine?
I don't have a breakout because when I look, you know, at these different places, they kind of include it in. You know, they say food and, you know, alcohol. But for sure, I mean...
How tacky is a cash bar?
I've been to plenty of weddings where there's cash bars and it's not tacky. You know, I mean, I think it's up to people, but, you know, I'm sure he'll back me up. I mean, you can lower the cost. Mm. One of the things they say is to do a signature cocktail. Well, instead of having champagne, have Prosecco, for example. But that's, you know, you're going to be doing this incrementally. What you really have to look at are what the big numbers are. So take a look at the venue, all right? One of the first things that you want to do is maybe not get married on a Saturday night, maybe not get married in April or September, because those are the two most popular months of the year, at least in North America.
Hmm.
Yes.
Not June?
Excuse me, June and September.
Oh.
Thank you.
Very impressive.
Thanks, Emily.
Say.
You know, and I shouldn't say that because I was married in April. Okay, so June and September, and look at other months. And why do you have to get married on a Saturday night? Why not have a Sunday brunch, for example, which will cut your...
A ruin your day party. Don't invite me.
Can we stay on what you said a minute ago? And by the way, if you have questions at 877-301-8970 for Cheryl about how you can cut costs without sacrificing the gestalt of the experience, give us a buzz. 877.
Or if they have a tip that, you know, I
exactly.
hard to believe that I wouldn't know it, but you never know.
301-8970. Jonathan, you don't find a cash bar tacky?
Yeah, I do.
At a wedding?
I mean, personally, I do. I think if you want to reduce your expenses on the bar, I mean, you know me. I mean, for me, wine is the answer to
right,
every question.
I agree.
When it comes to something like this, if you want to reduce, if you want to still have an open bar but want to reduce your expenses, have a wine bar.
Mm-hmm.
Pick a few special wines. Have wine. Have maybe beer, have sparkling water. Let it go at that.
What do you think of that, Cheryl?
I think that's a great idea. But as I said, that's just going to be a small amount.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking about, you know, the average cost is $27,000. But as you know, it varies by state. And guess which state is the most expensive to get married in?
The most expensive?
Yes.
Which one? Not
Why?
This.
No.
Which one?
New
California.
York.
Oh, New York.
Oh.
Okay.
New York City.
Oh.
But guess what else is pretty expensive?
What's
Rhode Island and Massachusetts are right up there. Rhode Island is
Newport
the fifth.
And all
right.
That.
the fifth most expensive, and Boston is the eighth most expensive. And interestingly enough, planning a destination wedding actually saves you a lot of money for several reasons. One is you're not thinking, oh, I should invite the neighbor across the street, you know, because you want to keep your guest list
down. Oh, destination, meaning a place
right,
other than where the people
correct.
Live. Okay.
Right.
Sorry.
So a destination like an island or Europe or something like that. And second thing, a lot of people don't want to pack up and go to a destination wedding, so you'll end up with a smaller
I know,
guest
but it's expensive
list.
For the people who go. A lot of people resent those destination weddings.
Well,
so
then
they
don't have to go, Emily. That's the whole point.
But don't you think, I'm with Emily, don't you think that's even tackier than a
no,
cash bar is saying you got to fly to the Turks and Caicos if you want to go to this wedding?
Okay, honestly, if you don't want to invite people, just don't invite them.
Just don't invite them, and they don't have to go. So that's one thing. But the second thing is, and Emily knows I'm the queen of context.
Okay,
I like context and everything, okay? So the entire industry, guess how big the entire wedding industry is in this country?
$7 billion.
How about
second only
$80
to pornography.
Billion? Dollars.
Is that really true?
$80 billion. Some estimates say 120. I think that's a little bit high. $80 billion. And again, because I'm the context queen, during the election when everyone was beefing about, you know, how much money was being paid to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the number was only in a couple of $100 million compared to what's spent on weddings. Mm. And you know how crazy everybody is about their dogs and cats and everything else?
Yeah.
The pet industry is only $55 billion as compared to what the wedding industry is. I mean, that's pretty massive. We're not even talking about other countries. I mean, India, I can't even imagine because, you know, the Indian weddings go on for a week at a time. But it is a huge business.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning here. At 877-301-8970, if you have questions or if you have tips about how to keep the cost down, tell when you mentioned the venue is a really big deal. If you don't want to put people in the position of having to fly or go to another location, you want to stay in town. Let's do Boston, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go to have a really nice wedding and not break the bank?
Well, I would suspect that some of the hotels will give you, you know, a good deal. I don't know which ones will. Interestingly enough, before I came in, I was looking in my inbox, and Groupon was offering a wedding.
No.
Yes.
Oh.
At the Mandarin Oriental Hotel.
Really?
At $35,000 for 100 guests.
And how much would it ordinarily be?
I can't even imagine.
A Groupon? For a wedding?
Groupon from the Mandarin Oriental. It was in my inbox. I was really surprised. So I thought that was, you know, very interesting. Also, we have beautiful places around here. The Boston Public Library.
That's not cheap.
Oh, it's not. Okay. Well,
wait a second. You can rent
many,
for an event at the Boston
I've
Public Library?
I've been there many times to a wedding.
Yep. Huh. Me too. Artists for Humanity, a spectacular facility in South Boston that in the daytime works with teenagers and teaching them about art and everything. And at night, it's a rental facility. There are all kinds of creative places, you know, you can go and have a wedding. Maybe you can borrow somebody's house.
Got it. Okay, let's go to Jessica in Narragansett.
You're nodding.
I'm nodding. These are difficult concepts. Let's go to Jessica in Narragansett. You're on with Emily Rooney, Jim Browdy, Cheryl Marshall, and Jonathan Alsop. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment that, like, my wedding, I had 120 people at, and it only cost us $10,000.
Whoa.
And that was because we found a venue that didn't need any, you know, extra decorations or extra lighting.
That's
all the
great.
Kind of little things that you don't think about
right.
that end up adding up.
Right.
And then we did a bunch of it ourselves. Like, you don't need to rent, you know, a table setting that costs $30 per person when you can go out and just, like, you know, get something a little less expensive that still looks just as nice.
That's great. Where did you get married? Can you tell us?
I actually got married in the Central Coast of California, which I know is a very expensive destination.
Yes.
But, you know, we made it work, and it's about the fun and the event, not necessarily, like, all the little tiny things that always end up.
What'd you do about the flowers, Jessica? That's one of the most outrageous expenses.
Yeah.
I offered to pay the flowers for my nephew's wedding, and it was like my eyes were rolling
back
in my head.
You rescinded?
Like, no, I did it, but it was like I couldn't believe it.
So what'd you do for the flowers, Jessica?
We actually went to the farmer's market the day before
Smart.
And picked out a bunch and then had the girls on the morning of the wedding put together their own little
That's
bouquets
great.
For the bride's
mm. name
and the centerpieces, and it ended up costing, I think, like $200 for maybe like 15 tables worth of centerpieces.
Mm.
Martha Stewart would be very proud
yes.
of you.
You should
That's
be in
the events
business.
That's one of the
business.
Things,
She's
right?
Great.
That's one
That's
of the
great.
Things that she talks
Thank
about.
Thank you, Jessica.
You know what else is recommended? that people do is to take all their wedding expenses and put them on their favorite credit card, or their favorite frequent flyer card. And then they can use the points afterwards to pay for their honeymoon.
But wait a second. That, part of your advice is that people should put, that's what I was going to ask in a few minutes. Putting your wedding on a credit card is a good, because of the points? Or, I mean, that's like a huge debt for people to have. Is it not, Cheryl?
Well,
Cheryl is choking.
Assuming that they're going to pay it off. They're not going to pay it off in time. It's just all they're doing is putting down the deposits and everything else.
So what you're saying is by the virtue of the size of the charge, you could potentially get enough free miles that you could go on your honeymoon.
And
you
could pay for part of your airline ticket or something like
hotels
that.
Hotels or anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a clever idea.
Hey, can I make a little pitch for vineyards and wineries as a great venue?
Yeah, a good
to get married. That's great.
Whether, you know, California comes immediately to mind. And again, I'm not, I don't guarantee that all of these places do weddings.
We're going to need an EMT for sure. I
know Truro Vineyards on Cape Cod.
I've been there.
They do lots of weddings. Westport
Great
Rivers down near Horseneck Beach is absolutely beautiful. Diamond Hill Vineyards in the it's actually in Rhode Island, but it's near South Attleboro, kind of the upper right-hand corner of Rhode Island. And that way you have the theme and the concept built in. Your centerpieces, they don't have to be expensive flowers.
No, because the vineyards are so beautiful.
They can be grapes. You know, vines.
Okay,
and
so we dealt with the venue issue. What's the next biggest expense other than venue, Cheryl Marshall?
Next biggest expense is, I'm going through my list right here.
What would that be?
The band.
Is the, the venue.
Uh-huh.
They're kind of divided up. You've got the reception band for $3,000. Photographer for $2,300. Emily, interestingly enough, the florist decor is not one of the highest ones. It's coming in at under $2,000.
Before you continue, while I catch your breath, David on the road actually has an idea about videoing the wedding and how you can save a few bucks. David, you're on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Emily Rooney, and Cheryl Marshall is about to expire. So make your point, and then she'll respond at some point. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. Not a topic I thought I would ever weigh in on, but my 16-year-old son is a videographer. He's been doing it for a couple of years, and he's done a number of weddings. And
that's great.
Does an amazing job, and what we find is people are, you know, very cautious about the idea of hiring a kind of non-professional until they see his reel. And I actually think that student filmmakers can do a better job than, you know, the sort of typical videographer charges a couple thousand bucks.
Wow.
And they deliver a very kind of formulaic thing. And a student filmmaker, you know, tends to do a more creative, you know, you have the photographer who's going to capture the critical moments anyway. But the video, you know, you kind of want a creative emotional story. Sometimes a film student can do that better than a kind of, quote, professional, and you can save probably two-thirds of the cost.
No one ever looks at it again anyway. So.
And also, pursuant to that, we have a lot of conservatories in Boston hiring student musicians.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of talented musicians here. I know for one of my husband's birthday parties, I hired a string quartet from Berkeley. They were phenomenal. And you're giving students a gig, too, so that's a great way to cut down our expenses. Or, you know, you can just hire a DJ. You don't have to have, you know, the Boston Symphony playing at your wedding.
But speaking of, what was the expression we used about the cash bar? There was what? What was the expression?
Tacky.
Isn't it tacky not to have a live band?
It's not.
Not
it's okay
not
to
anymore.
Play music?
Not anymore, especially with this generation of kids. They don't want a band all of the time. They want one of these, you know, happening DJs.
And what DJs are doing these days is, the concept is they're curating the music. You know, they're not just standing there pushing
right,
buttons.
Right, that's exactly
something's
right.
Something's actually happening.
But
they're feeling the crowd. It's more than
what we think of as... For almost all young women, regardless of their financial socioeconomic status, they start going to these brides' magazines. And before you know it, they're looking at this dream world. You know, the ice sculptures.
It is a dream.
The horse-drawn carriage.
It's all of that.
You know, the $9,000 dresses.
That's correct.
And you know, they don't want to settle for something. So before you know it, they've done one thing that's crazy, like bought the $9,000 dress. They're already 50% over budget.
Right.
And then it just starts snowballing, and they're tapping the relatives.
And also they get taken advantage of. They're very vulnerable. You know, you go into a hotel or a reception place, and you know they know that they've got someone who wants to have a perfect wedding. And
what's
so
the solution?
Sell up.
Now that we don't have the running of the brides, we don't have the running of the brides anymore, right?
No, they do. Somebody bought it.
Oh, they did?
Somebody bought it. And,
so how do you get a wedding dress that doesn't break the bank?
Oh, my goodness. There are so many websites that sell pre-owned, beautiful wedding dresses. Most of them have been dry cleaned. If they haven't, don't buy it. Okay. And, you know, you can save a fortune because, let's face it, these are dresses that are not worn 2, 3, and 4 times. So you can save a ton of money. Or you can go to a running of the brides things. Or, you know, you wait for sales or discontinued lines. You can easily save on a wedding dress. Easily.
Why do you look
no
like
one
this,
wants
Emily?
A used wedding dress.
I don't agree with you.
If it's been dry cleaned.
You know, no. Most of the time, people wear their dresses once. They go and spend, you know, hundreds of dollars to have them preserved, put in a box. I don't agree with you. I think people
are
happy.
I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I'm just saying people won't do it.
You're wrong, because there's two very successful wedding sites that sell. One is called Pre-Owned Wedding Dresses. They're going gangbusters.
What's the other one?
Vows, which is locally, except I forget what the website's called. They're based out of Watertown. I mean, they're doing great. There's a reason.
Let's squeeze one more in here. Rick from Pomfret, Connecticut. You're on with Cheryl Marshall and Jonathan Alsop. Hey, Rick.
Hey, thanks for having my call.
Pleasure.
I've been a musician my whole life, and when I finally got married after playing zillions of weddings, I did a destination wedding, so I agree with that idea. But I wanted to kind of stick up for live bands at weddings and disagree with Cheryl on that. I think that although there are great DJs that can be very entertaining, you can also get duds that really don't do much for the atmosphere. Whereas I think the one thing people walk out remembering, besides maybe the bride dress, is the band at the end of the night.
That's true, and that's what they say. It's not the food. It's not anything else. But I have been to weddings of, what generation is this now? Q, Y, Z?
I don't know.
Whatever, which one. And who've had just DJs. But the DJs, frankly, have been very, quote-unquote, entertaining. So I appreciate that. I'd always rather have live music.
Rick, thanks for your contributions. We only have a minute to go, Cheryl. Give us a couple of tips on the way out the door. Things that are immutable, things that people should incorporate into their wedding planning.
You mean things that they shouldn't change? Well, first of all, you think about what your priorities are. That's number one. If it's more important for you to have expensive wine and good food than to have a good band, then do that. If the most important thing for you is to have a good band, then do that. And then you can work, if you know and try and can be firm and try not to get snowed by, you know, the huge mega industrial bride industry, okay, then you can make yourself a really nice wedding without going broke.
And last question from me. So you would advise for or against Mogan David as the wine of the, what would you say, Cheryl?
Well, since I'm a member of your tribe.
You are?
Okay, you know.
You can't talk smack about Mogan David.
And I'm looking at that nasty bottle. And I laughed really hard because yesterday's New York Times, Melissa Clark, the food writer, actually gave recipes using Mogan David in the salad dressing.
I had to look at it twice. Hey, Cheryl Marshall, it was a pleasure, as always. Nice to see you. Thank you so much. Jonathan Alsop. You as well. Good to see you.
Thank you, too.
Emily, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks, and Marjorie's back tomorrow.
She is. And tomorrow, in addition to Marjorie, Chris Lydon, who's a former candidate for mayor, talks about Boston's current and maybe future mayor, and will visit with Yardley Smith. Now, if you don't recognize the name, you will recognize this.
He's pure gold. For once in your life, be cool.
So, is your name as pretty as your face?
Oh.
I am wildly excited about this. Lisa Simpson. I hope she doesn't mind that. In studio with us tomorrow. Emily, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Fun.
She's Emily Rooney. I am Jim Browdy. We'll be back, Marjorie and I, tomorrow at noon on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for being here.